The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter at @NewstalkScience. And so before we start, I just wanted to say a few things. I know a lot of you have been getting advice out there, some of it good, some of it not so good. Some of you have been felt that one thing should have been done by the government or your neighbour or not the other. Many of us are worried, and worry brings anxiety. It leads us to a criticism or acting in our own interests above others. Firstly, be more careful out there. I have two young boys and they are boisterous. I myself am very clumsy. Take a bit more time with everything. Think about what potential injuries might happen a little bit more than you might do. You don't want to be going to a hospital right now, and they don't need to see you either. Secondly, realise that the only way the restrictions are going to have any effect are if you realise that it's not just you or your loved ones at risk, it's everyone. I love my children with all my heart, but it will be hard on all of us to spend 24 hours of every day for 2, if not 5 weeks without any social contact. But this is an attempt to starve a deadly pandemic that's led to doctors having to make really upsetting decisions that don't bear thinking about in Italy and other countries. So playing out in the streets with other kids, pubs, weddings, we need to think about these in a greater context. And finally, there's probably something you can do to help others, whether that's offering an online service you normally charge for, or volunteering to help with delivering for people at risk, or even just doing the washing up for your mum who might have to work from home and could do it a dig out. You'll be glad you did and be remembered for it. So stay safe out there. Right, coming up on this week's programme, the science of ostracism and what it's like to be rejected. First, though, we're going to kick off with a look at the week's news stories, as we always do. And there is only one story this week. Joining me is Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology, Trinity College Dublin. You're very welcome to the programme, Kingston. As I said at the top of the programme, this is a very strange time indeed. And I'm sure people have overdosed on COVID-19 stories, but it seems sort of remiss not to cover this, the science of what's going on, and also to sort of pay tribute to the work that scientists are doing across the world, rushing to try and find something that will stop this pandemic. So maybe that's where we might start. What can we do from a scientific point of view to stop this disease?
Yes, I think actually some good news on the scientific front. There's been a huge amount of activity over the last few months, mainly in the US, I have to say, but also in China and some European countries, in two approaches. One, a potential vaccine to prevent further infections, which won't be available for some time, but something that may be available quicker than that are antiviral drugs, first of all, and secondly, repurposed drugs that may be useful in combating some of the severe complications of the disease. And both of these are being trialed in clinical trials right in the next weeks and months.
Is there nothing universal to viruses that we could attack with a therapy? When I heard that there were antiviral drugs out there, I was like, oh, of course there are, but why does one antiviral drug not work for another? Maybe you might take us through some of the approaches when you try and attack a virus in an organism.
Okay, so the two best examples of antiviral drugs that work really well are against hepatitis C virus infection, and the other one is against HIV. And these have been developed over a range of years, and they're all drug combinations. So initially, the drugs that were developed against HIV were moderately effective, but finally, they got a combination that worked really well. And the same was the case with hepatitis C virus. A combination worked really well, but they're all specific for the individual virus. So the HCV antiviral drugs don't work in other viruses, and the same with HIV. Now, it's slightly different with the drugs that are coming online for, hopefully, for COVID-19. And during the SARS epidemic, well, it wasn't an epidemic, a SARS crisis, let's call it that, and then the Ebola crisis, there were antiviral drugs developed against both of those. And of course, SARS is in the same family of viruses as COVID-19. So it turns out that there's a good chance that a drug that was developed initially against SARS, but also stockpiled in preparation for the Ebola situation, which actually petered out in the end, that this viral antiviral drug may be effective against the current COVID-19 virus. And that's now starting to be tested in what we call phase three clinical trials in Asia and in the US.
Right. So that's a drug that's already there that hasn't yet reached phase three. So
that's right.
So, and what's that drug called?
Remdesivir. So Remdesivir. Yeah. So it's a nucleotide analog. So what it does is to interfere with the replication of the virus. When a virus replicates or divides by getting inside a human cell, and then it uses the human replication machinery for its own replication. Mm. But what these drugs do is they interfere with that step, a step in the replication. They put in sort of stop signals, if you like, into the replication that stops it dividing. And now, unlike some of the other antiviral drugs, which are attacking what we call enzymes that the virus needs to replicate, this antiviral drug is more broadly effective than some others, in that it has an opportunity to interfere with the replication of different viruses.
Right.
Now, we don't know if it'll work with COVID-19, but the hope is that it will.
Is the problem with viruses that because they change in shape, the location of attack and the part of the organism or the mechanism that you're attacking changes all the time, and that's why it's so difficult to find a cure all for all viruses?
Yeah, I mean, the makeup of all viruses, first of all, is quite different. So something like a coronavirus is very different from influenza virus, and that's very different from some other viruses like hepatitis C virus. So one drug that will block one function of one type of virus won't necessarily work on another. And that's the big complication of trying to get an antiviral drug that is going to work specifically on a virus like COVID-19.
What about drugs that are already on the shelf that have passed through FDA approval, passed through approval in the EU? Are any of those being trialed for COVID-19? And how long will it take to figure out if these drugs that are already good to go will work?
Well, there are two drugs that are not antiviral drugs, but these are drugs that are used to treat arthritis. And that might sound bizarre, but rheumatoid arthritis is an inflammatory condition where there's an overactive immune response. And one of the pictures that's emerging from the pathogenesis of COVID-19 is that patients get severe complications associated with lung inflammation. So it seems like patients get what call a cytokine storm in the very severe cases. And this cytokine storm may end up killing the patient. So these drugs that are useful in treating rheumatoid arthritis are designed to stop this inflammation that causes arthritis, but similar inflammation can cause the complications of COVID-19. So some of the large pharma, Regeneron and Sanofi and Roche, have their antibodies that are against a messenger molecule of the immune system, a cytokine called interleukin-6. And this is patients that get COVID-19 get severe fevers, and the fevers are caused by the immune response to the virus. So they make these mediators which cause the fever. Well, the same mediators cause the damage in the lung, and these drugs that have already been developed and are licensed for treating arthritis, so they've gone through all the safety testing and they're ready to go, are now going to be tested in patients with severe COVID-19 to see if they can prevent deaths from the complications. They're not going to cure the disease, but they're going to prevent the death from complication if they work.
Right. Let's talk timelines. How long does it take to test something like that? How quickly before we get results? And if we get results, how on earth do you get a global supply of a drug in one day?
You don't get a global supply of a drug in one day for sure. These drugs, especially the anti-IL-6 antibody, they're made by biological processes which are complicated, but nearly all the large pharma have these processes in place already for making this type of drug. So this is the most common type of drug that's been made today, the therapeutic monoclonal antibodies. A company like Pfizer in Grange Castle in Dublin is making stocks of antibodies against other indications. So they're processes that are used all the time in the pharma industry. So cranking it up, you know, will take a little bit of while, but it's not impossible. So they have already the process in place to do that. On the other drug, the Remdesivir, that's a chemical entity, and chemical entities are actually easier to make than biological drugs like antibodies. So that can be done pretty quickly as well. But obviously, it's going to take weeks and months to crank up the level that would be required to treat you know, hundreds of thousands of people. That's if they were to work. Of course, this is all dependent on them working, and we won't know that until the clinical trials have been complete.
Finally, I wanted to talk very briefly about vaccines and how long it takes to get a vaccine to full production. I remember when SARS came out and other sort of swine flu viruses, people talked about 18 months. And I was really surprised that it would take that long if there was a global effort to try and get it to work. But why do vaccines take so long and how are they made?
Okay, so before SARS and COVID-19 and Ebola, and if we think back to, you know, things like meningococcus B and meningococcus C, these vaccines took 10 years to develop. So that's the process, that's the length of time it can take the process to go through. And why does it take that long? First of all, you have to identify what the immune response it is that protects you. Then you have to identify what the antigen you want to target. And then you have to go through phase one clinical trials for safety, phase two clinical trials for safety in larger groups of individuals, and then what we call efficacy trials, where you go out to the field and you immunize people that are exposed to the pathogen. And here we're talking about tens of thousands of people. And that could be over a year or two to test whether the safety or not. And then you have to go through licensing and all the necessary procedures. Now, with something like pandemic influenza, that was shortcutted pretty drastically shortcutted. And with COVID-19, it will also be there will be shortcuts in terms, not shortcuts, but it will be expedited. And the regulatory agencies like the FDA in the States and the European Medical Agency, the EMA in Europe, will have procedures in place to expedite the licensing and testing of vaccines against COVID-19. Right. Now, we have already got a number of candidate vaccines that are ready for testing. And the first one, a company called Moderna in Boston, has an mRNA vaccine. This is a new type of technology. They got it ready for testing in 42 days, which was pretty incredible. But it hasn't yet gone into humans, and it will go into humans next month in phase one clinical testing. But that's only phase one. Yeah. That's the very first step in the process. The most optimistic estimates are between 12 and 18 months. If it worked, that vaccine would be ready for use in the population. So that's the sort of time frame we're talking about. Might be possible to shorten that slightly, but we're really, you know, there's a lot of steps that have to be gone through. There's no point in putting on the market a vaccine that doesn't work or has safety issues. That's going to have caused more problems than one that doesn't. So, the regulatory agencies have to be absolutely assured there are no safety issues and that the vaccine actually works before it can go on the market.
One last question. In terms of live vaccines, are they still made in eggs or how are they kept alive?
So the influenza vaccine is made in eggs. It's the only one that's made in eggs. Now, it's a bizarre process in that for some reason, the virus replicates very effectively in embryonated hen eggs. And that traditionally has been the mode of production for influenza vaccines. But for COVID-19 vaccines, that's not the process. There's two potential types of vaccine. One is a nucleic acid or mRNA-based approach, and the other is a protein approach where you would take make in the laboratory the extracellular portion of the virus. The virus has proteins on its surface that allow it to bind to receptors on the cells in the respiratory tract. And so those proteins are the targets for the protective antibody. So what happens is that those proteins are synthesized in the lab, and that protein then becomes the vaccine. It's mixed with an adjuvant. So this is all done in a very much more sophisticated approach than growing in eggs. That was an old-fashioned approach that is still used for flu, but it's very unique to flu.
Well, Professor Kingston-Mills, of Trinity College Dublin. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, we humans are social animals. Social interactions are essential to maintaining this sense of belonging, and they allow us to engage more fully with our feelings and our emotions. So when we get sidelined or cut out of the gang, it can hurt. It can hurt a lot. But being ostracized is more than that. It can have terrible psychological and emotional effects on us. So why do we do it to others? And what function does it serve? Well, Dr. Kip Williams is a distinguished professor of psychological sciences from Purdue. He joins me now. Kip, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good morning.
Well, do we have a scientific definition for ostracism?
Ostracism means being ignored and excluded. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a group doing it to an individual. It could be one-on-one. So if you give your partner the silent treatment, that's a form of ostracism.
I find group dynamics and social interactions fascinating. It's always fascinated me how groups include one another, how they manage hierarchy, how one person is popular, how another is deemed to be out of sorts. How did you get involved in this field? What excited you about the idea of studying ostracism?
Well, about 1978, I was watching a documentary about a cadet at West Point who had violated the honor code, and they instituted the unwritten policy of silencing on him. So when he returned to his dorm, his roommate had moved out. When he walked down the hallway, nobody would look at him or talk to him or answer any questions he asked. When he went to the cafeteria, he would sit down at a table filled with cadets. They would all immediately stand up and leave. And he stayed there for another 2.5 years and graduated. But when I watched the program, I was just sort of blown away with how powerful a bunch of non-behaviors were. They didn't harass him. They didn't bully him. They didn't call him names. They simply acted as though he didn't exist. So at that point, I thought I wanted to study that at some time in the future.
He endured that for 2.5 years?
Yes, and he's not the only one. There was a Benjamin O. Davis Jr. back in 1936 who was ostracized or silenced from the moment he arrived, and he stuck it out and graduated to become a general. Why did they do that to him? Because he was African American, and they didn't want an African American at West Point at that time.
Right. So let's talk about the idea of ostracism. Is this something that we see in animals as well as humans?
Yes, all social animals have been observed engaging in ostracism. So
really?
It appears to be a ubiquitous behavior of all social animals, and probably because it was functional. Evolutionarily speaking, if a member of the group is a burden or somehow is endangering the safety of the group, then it's like a hardwired response to ostracize that individual, thus making the group slightly smaller but stronger.
The idea of banishment, I suppose, is something that we're familiar with probably from literature and pop culture, but that probably was a real thing back in the days when someone was acting very much against the good of the society.
Yes, yes. And it isn't something that's all bad or all good. It has its functionality, and it, especially in our ancestral past, it was probably vital for survival. But that doesn't mean it's not overused or abused or misused now.
I mean, when I think about it, it's quite a good analogy for biological evolution in a way, that you have an organism, a society, and that one part of that organism isn't working or isn't aiding the healthy continued survival of that organism. And so it's sort of jettisoned out. It sort of sounds a little bit like how mutations or unuseful traits sort of die out in populations over time.
Yeah, that's correct. And it isn't just a banishment that can make it work. Sometimes when ostracized, if the behavior is under the control of the individual, they can correct their behavior to fit in more. And so then they don't actually leave, but they correct their behavior and then they become a functional member of the group again.
I imagine during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, without the ethical sort of constraints that we have nowadays on psychology, there were some very interesting studies looking at what happens when you socially exclude somebody.
Well, you would like to think so, but there weren't. Basically, I was one of the first people to start to study this in any kind of concerted way. There were like 3 studies that had been done over 40 years that didn't go anywhere and were just sort of like, what happens when someone's ignored? And so that's one of the reasons why I wanted to study this, because our field had not looked at it, and yet it seemed to be so powerful.
Right. I'm reminded of that very seminal piece of work by Harry Harlow, which I suppose is different, where he got wire monkeys and cloth monkeys and sort of through his research, depending on how much you believe the conclusions, He sort of said that, you know, that people need touch and they need social interaction. And if they're only given just sustenance, it's not enough. But I suppose you're right, that's not looking at what happens when a group isolates somebody. It's a different thing, but it is about that sense of belonging.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they were physically isolated, and he showed that although they did need to get sustenance for a short period of time, they spent most of their time on the cloth monkey. So it is related, although it's not specifically the same.
So tell me how you study ostracism from a scientific point of view.
So I do it in any number of ways. So I have interviewed people who have experienced or endured ostracism for many years of their lives. And people who do it routinely. But most of my research is experimental, meaning that when participants come into our lab, they are randomly assigned to be included or ostracized for a short period of time.
I just want to jump in there before we get into that, Kip. And I'm wondering that first part of that, because I want to get into the research in a bit of depth. But perhaps you might tell me the story of someone who you've interviewed who had a really extraordinary account of being ostracized or ostracizing someone else.
Yeah, okay. So one was a woman who was, when she was 25, she got in an argument with her husband, and she couldn't recall what the argument was about, but he gave her the silent treatment. And at first she thought he'd get over it, and then she became pleading and sort of supplicating as much as possible. Then she became angry and started to try to provoke a response, and nothing worked. And he continued to give her the silent treatment. He wouldn't talk to her. He wouldn't look at her. He wouldn't eat at the same table with her for the next 40 years of their marriage. At that point, he passed away.
Oh my God.
And when we interviewed her, we said, you know, why did you stay in the marriage? And she said, well, at least I had a roof over my head. And that is what happens when somebody has to endure it for a really long period of time. I'm sure we'll get into this in a little bit, but the typical response immediately or soon after it's happening is to do something to change things. But after you've tried and tried and tried and nothing works, then you end up giving up and feeling helpless and depressed. And that was the case for her. Another sad story, a young woman's father would routinely get angry at her and then follow that up with 6 months or more of silent treatment. And one time he was in the middle of the silent treatment and he was in the hospital on his deathbed. And she felt like she needed to go talk to him despite that. And when she went to his hospital room, he looked at her for a second and then turned his head away. And she said, you know, Daddy, don't leave me. And he still wouldn't talk to her. And then lastly, I interviewed a father whose son misbehaved and said some really awful things. And the father didn't routinely give the silent treatment, but he just could not bring himself to talk to his son or look at his son after this event happened. And what he talked about was it was like a psychological quicksand that he couldn't stop doing it. And he noticed that his son turned into what he called a spineless jellyfish over a period of time and became quite depressed. And it took everything the father had to start to have monosyllabic answers or comments to his son to finally get back into it, which I think is important because if you get in a physical fight or a verbal fight, there's kind of a clear ending to it, and it's easier to kind of get back into normal. With the silent treatment or with ostracism, there is no clear endpoint, and so it sort of self-perpetuates, making it terrible for the person who's getting it, but also hard for the person who's doing it to stop doing it.
Yeah, and I think all of us have probably felt sometimes when you give someone the silent treatment, you feel like this is, you know, you've been hurt. So you're just going to shut down that communication for short periods of time. I'm sure lots of people have done it. And it is a very powerful, I suppose, psychological weapon. I am sure I've heard stories actually of Irish couples doing the same, living together under the same roof for years, but the man usually not talking to the woman for some perceived slight decades ago. I'd love to hear your stories. Actually, we get to comments and emails in the podcast. You can email us science@newstalk.com. if you have heard one of those stories of ostracism. So, Kip, when we're talking about the science of ostracism and the research that you do, you said you break people up into either included or excluded. What sort of experiments do you do on people to look at how they behave when they're ostracized?
Well, we've done a number of things. We've had conversations where two people are not including a third, and they talk over and they don't look at and they don't listen to the person. We've done it on chat rooms. We've done it on messaging. We've done it in a variety of ways. But the one that we end up using the most is a game that we developed called Cyberball. And this came from something that actually happened to me in real life about 8 years after I became interested in thinking about ostracism. I was at a park with my dog on a blanket, and a Frisbee rolled up behind me, and I turned around and saw two guys waiting for it. So I stood up and threw it back to them. And to my surprise, they continued to throw it to me. So I approached them, and the three of us were throwing it around. We didn't talk to each other or anything. We were just throwing it. But then for reasons I still don't know, they stopped throwing it to me. And I stood there feeling kind of awkward and at first thinking it was funny, and then finally realizing they were never going to throw it to me again. So I ended up going back and sitting with my dog. But at that point, I thought, hey, that is a very powerful and kind of context-free method of ostracizing somebody.
Oh, my God, so, that is crushing. If that happened to me, I have to say, I think I might cry.
Well, I might have had I not been interested in studying ostracism. Hmm. So that gave me a kind of I was able to distance myself from the psychological feeling and think, wow, I could use this in the lab. So basically, I developed a game called Cyberball where people come in, they sit in their own cubicle, and they're told that they're going to engage in a mental visualization task where they're going to be tossing a virtual ball among the other two participants. And they see these little cartoon characters, including themselves at the bottom. And when the ball comes to them, they're to click the one person or the other, and the ball goes to them. And I tell them that we don't care who's getting the ball and who's throwing it. What we care about is that they mentally visualize, thinking, who are these people? Where are they? And that's what is called a cover story. We're trying to get them to think we're studying one thing, but in fact, we are interested in how they behave differently or how they think differently or how they feel differently if they're not getting the ball versus they are getting the ball. So
you have ordinarily you'd have some sort of confederate, this some sort of a sort of spy on your team that would involve this ostracism. But in the computer game, of course, you don't need that. You can sort of code it so that eventually this person who doesn't know they're going to be ostracized gets ostracized.
That's right. We actually started by having two confederates, and they were sitting in a lab, and while they were waiting for the experiment to begin, they would find a ball on the floor and start tossing it. And we didn't know whether that would work or not, but it turns out everybody caught the ball and threw it. And it didn't seem to be part of the experiment. It just seemed to be something that happened prior to the experiment beginning. But the two confederates were given a signal to either include the person equally or to throw it to them three or four times at the beginning and then never again, much like what happened to me in the park. And it was so powerful and it was so difficult to watch. And the Confederates felt terrible. But it's also very inefficient to do it that way. So we thought, let's tone it down a little bit by developing this Cyberball game. And what surprises is that the Cyberball game ends up being just as powerful, despite the fact that the person isn't even in the same room with the other two people, and they haven't met those people, and they don't even intend to meet those people. So we thought that, and my colleagues said, you're wasting your time. This is not going to bother anybody. So at the time we started this, people didn't think this was going to matter. But as it turned out, we get these very large effects.
So to clarify for people, a volunteer walks into a room, there's a screen with three sort of avatars, and one of them represents that volunteer. And then the volunteer is allowed to pass the ball to the other two. And after a while, they all pass amongst themselves. And after a while, the volunteer is completely excluded and the two other players just pass to each other. And that's the idea. The idea is that this, just this including and then just for completely arbitrary reason, exclusion of that group can have really powerful feelings. What are they? What happens when in real life or in front of a computer screen when someone is just kicked out of the gang?
So what happens, I can talk about it at several levels. At the brain level, what we find is, and here the slight alteration is that instead of in a cubicle, they're laying down in an MRI scanner. But they believe that we're interested in the effects of mental visualization, on what happens in the brain. But in fact, we're interested in what does ostracism look like in the brain. And what we find is that the area of the brain, a very primitive area called the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, is activated when the person is no longer throwing the ball compared to when they were throwing the ball. And this region of the brain is the same region that is activated when people experience physical pain, when they touch fire, when they when a pin pricks their finger, when they put their hand in ice cold water, any type of physical pain, the first place that registers in the brain is the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. So what is surprising here is that something as seemingly innocuous as not getting an imaginary ball from two other people that they don't know is sufficient to be detected as pain. And it turns out social pain basically piggybacks on physical pain in the brain. It uses the same neural architecture, probably for efficiency reasons. But that's the first signal. And that signal is probably very adaptive. It's saying, hey, this is important. This is from our ancestral past. This was something that could mean you were going to die, because indeed, people who are ostracized many thousands of years ago, or social animals that are still ostracized, they usually die within a week. So it's had very important survival implications. And so this pain is an adaptive response to that says this is an alarm. You better pay attention to it. We then find that four fundamental needs are threatened, and these are needs that pre-existed my research that psychology has found were important in that if these needs are satisfied, you are able to conduct your life in a healthy manner, in a productive manner, and you're able to be to rise to the challenge of difficult tasks and things like that without giving up. And that these four needs are belonging, the need to feel connected to other people, self-esteem, the need to feel that you are competent and at least well-liked enough. You don't have to be like at the top of the scale, but reasonably high. The need to feel that you have control over your social situation, and that what you do has a consequence on other people. And finally, the need for what we call meaningful existence, the need to feel that you are acknowledged by other people and that you are important enough to be noticed.
It sounds to me that you're referencing that, that those kind of upper layers of Abraham Maslow's pyramid of needs.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. It's not necessarily the case that we find support for the order of those needs, but you can connect each of those needs with those with his. Yes.
Yeah. Just for listeners, this is a sort of a pyramid that's sort of established by a guy called Abraham Maslow, a sort of a Jewish psychologist who went to America in the 50s and just saw all this materialism around him and wondered what the hell life was about. And he built this pyramid of ideas that we needed at the very bottom. We needed food and shelter. And at the very top, we wanted self-fulfillment. And that basically we needed to order our lives to sort of to feed some of these needs. And it sounds like when you talk about cyberball and ostracism, you're very much talking about this need, this social set of needs that we have to be in a group, feel like other people like us, feel that we are important in other people's eyes and so on.
Yeah. And in addition to that, the control need is maybe not necessarily as social, but it turns out to be important, because if you feel like what you do has no consequences on what's going on around you, at first you try to regain that by exerting more control, but soon after you develop what's called learned helplessness and you just give up in general. So that's a very important need. When you're ostracized, no matter what you do or what you say, it has no impact. If you're in a physical fight, they can punch you, you can punch back. Mm. You feel a sense of control. If somebody is arguing with you and insulting you, you could try to make things better or make things worse yourself. But in any case, whatever you do is going to have an effect on what goes on. But when you're ostracized, nothing you do matters. Yeah. And that it makes it very frustrating.
And what are the more extreme... I mean, obviously, in the fMRI, you saw this brain activity, but maybe in real life situations where there was much more importance on the shoulders of someone who's being ostracized, what sort of effects did we see? Like, obviously, people would be upset about it and frustrated, but did that lead to further complications associated with anxiety?
Yeah. So in addition to those need threats, you also feel sad and angry. You actually lose a sense of what you stand for or self-certainty. But then it also has effects on your behaviors. And what we see in the lab and what also plays out in real life is that there are three paths that people seem to follow when they are ostracized. And these paths are to fortify the needs that have been threatened. So the first and most likely thing is that you try to become nicer or more agreeable or a better citizen within your group. You do stuff so they'll re-include you. And you might do this with the group that's ostracizing you, or you might be more likely to do it with a new group. But you kind of up your game in terms of being agreeable and likable. And that all sounds good, except what we find is that people are willing to conform to a clearly incorrect unanimous group when they've been ostracized. So they know what they're saying is wrong, but they just go along to get along. They are more likely to comply with a request for money. They are more likely to obey a request that they ordinarily wouldn't do and that it wouldn't be really advised that they do. They are more likely to non-consciously mimic somebody they're talking with. They're more likely to work harder on a group task where their contribution is submerged within the rest of the groups. So these are all behaviors that people do in real life and in the lab to kind of increase their inclusionary status.
It reminds me of that obedience study, that overlap of, you know, if you're to be in the group, you better do what you're told.
That's right. Unfortunately, there's also two other paths that are probably even worse. The second one is that if the chance of re-inclusion is missing or not available, then to restore a sense of control and to provoke acknowledgement so that people notice you, you can become antisocial or aggressive or in some cases even violent. And so you see people lashing out. And this occurs in real life too. You hear that people will just want a response, any response. And so they're no longer worried about being liked. They're worried about being noticed, and they will go to extremes just to be noticed. And
what are real life examples of that look like?
Yeah, well, real life examples of that, unfortunately, are, at least in the United States, are prevalent and seem to happen on a weekly basis. But you get people who feel marginalized, feel invisible, feel like nobody's looking at them. So they will go out and shoot people. And they go, you know, it seems like the more people you shoot, the more people the more you're noticed. And so these people are trying to be noticed and not really worried about whether they're liked. And just so that people don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying that ostracism always leads to,
violence,
being a multiple shooter. Having access to weapons and having some mental instability are also important, but it is a contributor to that type of behavior. If you ask people, you know, how could you be noticed worldwide today? Really, the only answer that can be given is to do something very violent.
What about the third phase then? You talked about people trying to ingratiate themselves, then lashing out. The last then is what?
Well, I call it turtling, like what a turtle does with its head. It starts, people self-isolate. They crawl into their own space, their own room. They don't venture out. They're taking control of not being ostracized by others by ostracizing others first. So they don't give others a chance to ostracize them. They become extremely rejection sensitive, and they just hole up. And so, unfortunately, the lashing out response and the self-isolation response both lead to more ostracism. So it becomes a perpetual cycle.
You did a study called the Scarlet O study. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it really wasn't meant to be a published study when we first came up with it. I was leaving my university in Toledo, Ohio to go to Australia, where I ended up working for 7 or 8 years. And I had 1 week left, and I proposed to my colleague and our three graduate students who are all on the fifth floor of the building that we each day, one of us will be ostracized and there'll be a scarlet letter O above that person's door, according to some random selection. And when we came in the morning, we'd see who that O belonged to. And if you were the person who was who's had that letter on their door, you knew that you were in for being ostracized for the whole day. If you were the other people, you knew that you would be ostracizing that person for the whole day. And we said, you know, whenever you think about it, whenever it comes to mind, make it a diary entry. How did it make you feel? What was happening? How did it make you feel? How did it make you behave differently? And again, a lot of my colleagues on the other floor says, well, that's dumb. You all know what you're doing. You're all agreeing to do it. It's not going to have any impact whatsoever. And they were so wrong. That was the week from hell for all of us. It was so difficult to go through the whole day and not be looked at and not be responded to and not be included. And then it was also very difficult to maintain the behavior in terms of being the ostracizer. We would have group meetings where we would be talking about important upcoming research. And when it was over, we go, I can't even remember what we were talking about because I was so worried about ostracizing that person. And so what we found was that being ostracized was very
Disruptive, yeah.
The person who was having it done to them, and they felt terrible, and they would try all these things too. They would try to be provocative, or they'd try to be extra nice. One person brought cookies in to hand them out. We did all kinds of different things to cope with it. But I think the extra surprise was just how difficult it was to maintain this non-normative behavior of not looking at, not talking to. And so that was disruptive to people that did it as well.
Yeah. So I want to maybe finish with this because there might be people listening who are currently being given the cold shoulder, the silent treatment or ostracized, maybe for a few hours because of something they did that to annoy their partner, their dad or their child or mom, whoever, or maybe there are people listening who have been given that treatment for years. What do you do if you are being ignored by someone who is in your life? Is there any advice you can give people who are being ostracized?
Yeah, one of the nice things we have found is that let's say you're ostracized by five people, you don't need five people to include you. You need one person to include you. You need, and so seeking and nurturing a mutually supportive relationship with one other person that's either in that group or even outside that group does a lot to defray the problem. So it only takes one person, if you observe somebody being ostracized, to go in there, acknowledge their existence, and you know, be an ally. It is surprisingly helpful just to have that one extra person. So that's something that people can do. And I think it's important that support is bilateral, meaning that it's not just you getting support from somebody else if you are the person being ostracized, but you should also be giving support to that other person because that shows you that you can affect other people. So that helps you reclaim in a positive way the control that you lack from being ostracized.
I think it can be an extraordinary cruelty at times, and I've seen it be very hurtful in the years of my life. So really interesting to talk to you about it. Dr. Kip Williams from Purdue, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I have to say I find that fascinating as someone, you know, who wasn't particularly popular in school because of my buddy Holly glasses and my afro, sort of felt a bit like I never felt like I was in the in crowd. There was a bunch of people. Actually, I went to a school where there wasn't, you know, they were actually decent people. Like, it wasn't like you see in the movies. The girls weren't bitches. The guys weren't a-holes. I just wasn't part of the slightly cooler group. And this power play between cool and not cool, in and out, has always fascinated me. Love to know what you make of that. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. One of the things that really struck me is that we do this online quite a bit now. I don't know if a perfect example is if you ever read John Ronson's book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And in it, he tells one of the stories about Justine Sacco, a PR person who was working in New York, went to London, and she used to make these sort of pithy, amusing observations of people. She says, oh, I've landed in the country of bad teeth. Welcome to London. And then she was, you know, made a few tweets about her trip to London. And then as she boarded a plane to Africa, she went, just about to board a plane to Africa. Hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding. I'm white. And she pressed send and she got on the plane. And of course, flight mode on. She was on a 13-hour flight, I think it was to South Africa. Over the course of that 13 hours, the story that she just tweeted, she maybe had like 150 followers or something, 300 followers. By the time she was an hour in, she'd lost her job. By the time she was 3 hours in, she was trending in America. By the time she was 5 hours in, there was press releases and there was the trending topic was, has Justine Sacco landed yet? And people were now getting together in bars following the Twitter feed to see what would happen when she arrived and wondering, would people be picketing her? There was a huge thunderstorm of shunning, disapproving, lots of people from all sorts of organizations across America and the world, you know, giving out about this one woman's tweet. And when she landed, she was met by a family member and just basically herded into a car because she had no idea what was about to come. And she was ostracized immensely for giving her the benefit of the doubt. Was a joke about how the modern world doesn't care about black people as much as they care about white people. And that's what I read into the tweet, but essentially that wasn't seen by men. It was seen to be extremely insensitive, which I totally agree with, and a stupid thing to make a joke about. But I think her point was, you know, it seemed to me that the point was that black lives aren't worth as much as white lives in this screwed up world that we live in. Anyway, the story of John Ronson interviews her and talks about like what happened, that ostracism that she had, completely shunned by everyone, banned from, you know, essentially living for 6 months, had obviously pretty serious effect on her. And we like to jump on that bandwagon a bit on the internet, don't we? Like when someone makes a mistake, we like to grind them down. There's something that makes us feel good about that. When I say us, I made a vow. I mean, I never really liked that, but I made a vow about a year ago that I would never say anything negative about somebody. And I even tried to do that with Trump. But when I say we, I mean us as a society, you know, the idea that if someone does wrong, we want to jump on in, because it's sort of virtue signaling. It's sort of showing that you are a good person because you totally disagree with that person. It can be hugely hurtful, as we know. I find that whole subject fascinating. So if you have been ostracized, or if you've ostracized someone else and now regret it, I'd love to hear what happened. Like, what was the big sin that caused this cold shoulder, silent treatment stuff? Have you ever been ostracized in a relationship?
I have not.
In a relationship, you never got the silent treatment.
I guess in small, you know, I'd say in a lot of relationships, you might get it for 20 minutes reason.
Yeah.
That's a tactic that some people use. Yeah. It's not my tactic.
It can be effective. It can be effective. You know,
it can be very effective.
And actually, with children particularly, you know, so I have two boys, as you might know. When with the two kids, like when you're really frustrated, you know, you've been asked them to do something, they've just not been, they've either been really either stupid or dangerous or whatever it is, and you think, you know, enough is enough. They're not listening. I don't want to raise my voice. Withdrawing attention from them is extremely powerful. It should not be used lightly, but just giving them 10 seconds of not looking in their direction, not speaking to a child, and they will all of a sudden be paying attention to you and saying, I'm sorry, Dad, and I will not do that again. But you can, like, that's why I say it's a cruel thing to do for a long period of time.
Yeah, it feels really, really mean. Kip was alluding to there, there's something innate within us that needs to have that not happen.
And so just so for the avoidance of any doubt, this is not something I do to my children, but I have done it for 10 seconds. So just going to cover some of your emails and tweets and texts from last week. We were talking about Waterworld and the idea that Earth used to be a blue marble, and that textured land and sea vista that we have become so familiar with from early photographs of the moon to the more modern images taken from space. It used to be blue, all blue. Ferguson County Clare says that Waterworld 3 billion years ago, the Earth was much smaller, continues to expand at the same rate as the universe. Therefore, the space available for surface water was less, and so covered heavier solid. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if I fully like, so as it expands, like what's expanding? I don't know, Fergus. I'd like to hear more information on this. I'd like substantiation on your idea that the Earth continues to expand at the same rate as the universe.
I thought it was just space-time that was expanding, and the matter within it doesn't get bigger, as far as I'm aware.
It can't get bigger. It's not like the atoms double. So it can't get bigger that way. And it's certainly not the space in between the atoms, because then surely bonds would break and everything would... I think you're wrong, Fergus, is what I'm going to say as politely as I can. But I always defer to people who can back up their argument. So more information, please, Fergus from County Clare. Alex says, watched a documentary several years ago about Earth being a water world. Also, recently, scientists proved that there's more water under the continents than in oceans. In fact, we are floating, in essence. Yeah, interesting. Kim Stanley Robinson wrote excellent sci-fi of all ice melts, sea gets heavier and pushes all subterranean water, sinking all land. 40 Seasons of Rain, I think it was called. I'm not a big sci-fi fan. I think I read sci-fi. I don't know. I just can't step into that world. I can watch it, but I can't. And usually in a film, I can't watch like episodic sci-fi. I don't know what it is. It needs to be really big. And, you know, sort of when you have to return to the same characters over and over again, it feels a bit like melodrama. That's why I couldn't really get into Star Trek in the same way, although I did appreciate it. Not that anyone was asking. On Xenobots, we talked about this incredible idea of taking frog heart cells and frog skin cells, sticking them together and making sort of machines out of them, and that are not quite robot and not quite living thing. Someone says, I've got one of those half robot, half living things. He croaks at me sometimes. He's known as my husband. Thank you very much. And Claire O'Keefe said, what about ethics when you come to Xenobots? What is your take on merging living things and non-living things? Well, so they work on blastocysts. They work on clumps of brain cells. There is definitely a definition of what you cannot work on in science. So if you're, you know, if you're talking about early life, you can work on, you know, one cell goes to two cells, goes to four cells, and somewhere in there is a blastocyst, and then it goes on and on. After a while, you're not allowed to do that with living cells. Here, we're talking about muscle cells and skin cells. There's no system. There's no brain. There's no spine. There's no nervous system. There's no it's obviously sense capabilities within the cells. But it's not that it cannot feel pain. And so I don't know. I think even though it is a weird thing to think about, I'm okay with it. What do you think?
Yeah, in the briefing chat, actually didn't make it into the interview, but I did talk briefly with Sam about it. And he just said, kind of what you just said there, he said, they're just muscle cells, they're just skin cells. If it was a situation where people were trying to do the same thing, which I suppose in theory they could do with brain cells or neurons, or then he would have reservations ethics wise about it, but for the moment he's not too worried because they're just muscle cells.
Yeah, I get it, Claire, but I sort of think, yeah, I mean, it is kind of weird. It's like taking a leg off someone and saying it's not even got a brain, it's just a leg. We spoke to Jim Al-Khalili, and someone emailed in. Do they have a name, or we just kept them out? Maybe we kept it out for reasons of the context. Person says, time is the direction of entropy. That is a big statement. I'm not quite sure what it means fully. But they say the reason why quantum-sized particles can be in two places at once is because time is less rigid at a scale where entropy is very, very high. Okay, I find the entropy thing and the time, the space-time bending, you need to be a better science broadcaster, I think, to, you know, there are those out there who can get that and probably do this show and but they probably get paid more than I do. I don't get it. The presenter of this program is thankfully level-minded and asking great questions. All right. But how on earth can we have this discussion without even mention of God? I suggest you Google Robert Spitzer S.J., no thanks, who is a philosopher and physicist, do balance on this discussion. It's important.
Do you know what? I could stick God into everything. We could talk about, you know, plastic waste, and we could talk about God in there. We could talk about God anyway. It's just not, I just don't see a place for that discussion, because it just brings in a total theoretical element to something where we're talking about stuff we've observed. And that's the idea of science, I suppose, is that we're observing with stuff we know that we've observed, we can test it and other people check it out. And when you bring God into this and say, well, we ought to talk about God in this, it's kind of like, well, we've got to bring infinity into this simple addition sum to me. It's kind of like, well, 4 + 4 = 8. Yeah, but what about infinity? It's like, well, my brain can't go there because it doesn't seem to logically fit. Maybe it's because I compartmentalize that idea of what we can see and measure and so on that we call science. And then this idea that maybe possibly there's something out there. And, I don't believe there is. I don't know for sure, but I just feel like it just has no place in this conversation. It has no place in most science. But you could say, if we're talking about, we could say, you know, is there a gap there at the beginning where God could be? Another says, if this interview is live, it's not. Please ask your guest to give a similar 30-second description of medical MRI imaging. So medical resonance imaging is using an enormous magnet to look at blood flow because there is iron particles in your blood. That's my understanding of it. That's about as good as you're going to get. That's all. I hope I'm right about that. You can let me know if I'm wrong. And so you can see where things are by looking at by using a big magnet. I think that's right.
I'm impressed.
I think it's something to do with it. It would make sense to me. We were talking about being the first Irish astronaut as well. And Louth GAA fan said, first Irish astronaut, did you say? Famous astronauts with links to Ireland, from Neil Armstrong to Chris Hadfield, and he links to articles about other people. I think it's fair to say there haven't been many Irish astronauts, if any Irish, depends on, I don't want to be xenophobic, but like, you know, the traditional sense of Irish, maybe they have Irish genes, or like Neil Armstrong probably is Irish, has Irish blood in him, but like, it's not quite the same, is it?
Sort of like that thing we always give out about with the English media going like, oh, that player is British.
I think we haven't had, like, we certainly haven't had, we haven't had an Irish astronaut. I mean, there's no jumping around it. And then someone else finishes up with a random text, which we sometimes talk on the program if we haven't got anything else to do. And why not? How do I get rid of weeds on the patio without using a poisonous spray? That I want to do it because there are children around. You can use a flamethrower. I've seen that used. Have you ever seen people flamethrow that stuff? And actually, do you know what's quite good is a power spray, like using a power spray to go. I would say let the weeds be on the patio. You know, they are there for a reason. They're living things. Why do you think? Why do you get the patio and the weeds doesn't get? No, forget that. This is really not my area. I've really wanted into. speculation here. I don't know, ask a gardener or a gardening show. Right, that's it from us for this week's episode. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producer. On sound was Jojo Cardoso. I'm researching with Simon Keane. Just a note on COVID, stay safe out there. Realize that we do need to protect everybody. So if you're not at risk, you still need to think about your actions to protect those who might be. Everyone knows somebody who has some sort of, immunosuppressant thing going on, or who is elderly. You'd be surprised how many people are at risk of this disease. So do be careful out there, and we'll see you next week.